As we come again to our study of Genesis, tonight we want to look at the six-day creation process specifically. And, of course, this process that we're going to look at is going to result ultimately in the earth being made ready for man. Man is the apex of God's creation, created in the image of God, and everything else that exists was created with man in mind. And so as we look at these 6 days, as we take just sort of an overview of each of the days, we want to keep that as sort of the backdrop, that all of this that God is doing is preparatory for man. It's amazing when you think of it in those terms. But before we get to the 6 days, one thing that we haven't yet touched on that I think we need to just momentarily talk about, and that is the authorship of Genesis. We've looked at many different things in the opening studies of Genesis here, but we need to also look at the authorship of this book. Now, I think it is indisputable that Moses is the author of Genesis, inasmuch as Moses is clearly the author of the law. Now, the law is a reference to the first five books of the Bible: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It is also referred to as the Torah, and it is referred to as the Pentateuch. Now, in Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 and 22, Paul says something interesting. He says, "You who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons." Now, Paul is quoting from Genesis, and he, of course, is referring to Genesis as the law. 23 times the law is called the law of Moses. Now, although the Bible tells us that the law was written by Moses, certain so-called Bible scholars, who are really nothing more than Bible critics, they have denied the authorship to Moses, and they have suggested that the law, these first five books, they have suggested that they were written between 850 and 620 BC by a variety of authors. This theory is known as the documentary hypothesis. It's also known as the JEDP hypothesis, each of those letters standing for those that they feel were the writers. The J stands for the Jehovist, the E stands for the Elohist, the D stands for the Deuteronomist, and the P stands for the priestly. Now, you're going to see in a moment that I have a specific reason for addressing this. But here's a question. What is the driving force behind these ideas? I mean, after all, why would somebody even consider to challenge the Mosaic authorship of this book when the Bible clearly teaches us that Moses wrote it? What's behind this? What is the driving force? Well, once again, it is evolution. I'd like to quote to you from Henry Morris. He says, "Adherents of this odd idea have attempted to justify it." I like the way he refers to it, an odd idea. Yes. They've attempted to justify it on the basis of supposed peculiarities of language and style, references to customs and cultures, and other internal evidence which seem to them to warrant this patchwork approach to the study of the book's compilation. No doubt their real reason, however, was their basic commitment to the evolutionary concept of man's development. The original higher critics, as such scholars were called, were convinced that man had not evolved to the state of culture described in Genesis until much later than the time of Moses, and that, in fact, Moses could not have written any part of Genesis or the rest of the Pentateuch since writing was unknown in his day. These evolutionary presuppositions were quite false, Moore says. However, most of them have been thoroughly repudiated by modern archaeological excavation. Today it is beyond question that writing was practiced widely and in many forms long before the time of Moses. This is acknowledged even by evolutionary anthropologists. One of the leaders in this field, a man named Ralph Linton, says, writing appears almost simultaneously 5,000 to 6,000 years ago in Egypt, Mesopotamia, and the Indus Valley. The time of Moses, of course, was only around 3,500 years ago. So, why am I bringing this up? Because, although these theories were debunked decades ago, they are still being spread today. They are still the dominant views that are being espoused in universities today, and on the more popular level, they are being dispersed through avenues like the Discovery Channel, the History Channel. Occasionally, some of the news periodicals will do a piece on a biblical kind of a theme. And in each and every one of these cases, you will find them referring to the documentary hypothesis, or their view and their ideas are these same kinds of ideas, even though they have been debunked so long ago. So it's important for us to have an understanding of that, because here's what's going to happen. One of your friends or family members or somebody else is going to say, hey, you know, I was watching the History Channel the other night and they had this thing on there, and, you know, it was about the Bible, and then they'll go on to tell you some bizarre thing about it, and they'll mention that several scholars were there, and they were vouching for that position and so forth. So we need to understand where this stuff is coming from, and then, of course, be able to give a good response to those who are asking those questions. I find quite often that whenever there is a program on, people get a little bit rattled. People suddenly are wondering, well, okay, you know, I believe the Bible, and of course I trust it, but these scholars said this. But again, we have to remember where they're coming from. We have to remember what's motivating them. We have to remember that they have been influenced by this evolutionary thinking process, and they're still holding on to, and they're still trying to perpetuate things that have been long ago disproven. I mean, it's pretty astounding, really, to think that they're still doing that. But that is indeed the case. So Moses is the author of Genesis, unquestionably. And, of course, Jesus certainly thought Moses was the author. And I think I will go with Jesus myself, and these other so-called scholars, they can argue amongst themselves. Moses is the author, but again, here's another question. How did Moses receive his information? Because obviously Moses wasn't there when these things transpired. There are three theories about how Moses wrote the book of Genesis, and this is pretty much exclusive to his authorship of Genesis, because we know Moses wrote Exodus because Moses is one of the main subjects of the book of Exodus. But here we're dealing with events that transpired long before Moses ever came onto the scene. So there are three theories. The first being that Moses had a direct revelation from God concerning these things, that God more or less dictated these things to Moses, perhaps in audible words, or maybe with visions of great events of the past. That's one theory. And it could be that that's the way it was done. Another theory is that oral tradition had been passed down from generation to generation, and Moses received that oral tradition, but he was also guided by the Holy Spirit to assure that he was passing on the correct information. That's a second theory. And then the third theory is this, that Moses actually took written records of the past, collected them, and brought them together into a final form, and all of that was, again, under the direction of the Holy Spirit. Now, I tend to think that the third theory is the most probable one, myself. Because if you think about it, there's no reason to believe that Adam himself would not have communicated these things to his descendants. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that he would not have communicated them in written form. So we have this line that we can follow. We have Adam. Well, of course, we even take a step back further. God would have communicated the very earliest things even to Adam, because he wasn't there to know what happened in the first 5 days of creation. So you have God to Adam, Adam to his son Seth, Seth then passing this information on to Noah, Noah passing it on to Shem, Shem to Abraham, Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to Joseph, Joseph, of course, then it would have passed on to Moses. So you can see that it would have been quite easy, because some of these men, their lives overlapped one another. You could see that these things could have easily been written down, passed on. And then Moses, as he's putting together the Torah, the law, Moses then compiles these things, and that's how we have what we know today as the book of Genesis. So again, any one of the theories I think has validity. I personally think that the third one, though, is the better one. So having said that, having stated the Mosaic authorship of Genesis, let's go ahead now, and we're actually going to get through the 6 days of creation tonight, and we'll move on from there, looking in the future more specifically at the creation of man. But let's look at the first 6 days. And so let me read to you the account of day one. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. And so here we have the first day. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So here we have, on the first day, God brings the material universe into existence, which, of course, includes the earth. Now, we use this term universe to basically describe everything that there is. The Hebrews, when they wanted to describe everything that existed, the terms that they used are the terms that we find in the very first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is the Hebrew way of expressing our idea of the universe. And so that's what we're told here. On day one, God brings the material universe into existence. Now, it wasn't all that long ago that we didn't really have any idea of the vastness of the universe. We didn't really have any idea of the numbers of stars. We didn't even really know that there were other galaxies. But the things we know today, it is just astounding when you stop and think of it. And, you know, for me, and I would encourage you in this direction as well, when I sit and think about these things, and these are good things to ponder. You know, it's good to ponder creation, because creation magnifies the Lord. And, you know, as you sit and you think about the vastness of the universe, it becomes really, it's mind-boggling, almost in a literal sense. You know, you just get to a point where you think, I just can't even begin to grasp this stuff. And for me, when I think about it and the greatness of it, again, as I was saying, what it does for me is it magnifies the Lord. I think if we live in a universe like this, what do you say about the one who made this whole universe? Now, the universe is made up of galaxies, and as you know, galaxies are groupings of stars. The estimated number of galaxies, this is the estimated number of galaxies, is one septillion. One septillion is a billion billion. A billion billion. Now, I remember 25 years ago, or almost 30 years ago, I remember sitting here, and as Pastor Chuck would be teaching, and he would be talking sometimes about these kinds of things, talking about the vastness of the universe. And I remember back in those days, he would quote the authorities at the, you know, what they were saying at the present time. They were talking about the universe being, say, 15 billion light years in diameter. And of course, that in and of itself is absolutely mind-boggling. We can't even conceive of it. But what's happened in the past 25 or 30 years is that they've realized that it's even much bigger than they thought it was back then. If 15 billion light years wasn't big enough, now the present estimation today is that the universe is 156 billion light years in diameter. Now, listen. None of us can figure that out. It's beyond us. And, you know, here's a question. And this is sometimes what the critics will say. They will say, well, you know, the universe is so big, and now they seem to think that, you know, planet Earth is so small, and because of the vastness of the universe, it seems to some to make Earth even more irrelevant. You know, they would say things like, well, you know, why would God make such a vast universe and have something as small and irrelevant as the Earth as the center of it? And, you know, they use that to criticize the idea of a creator. But David told us what God had in mind when he created this vast universe. The heavens declare the glory of God. You know what God is doing? He's doing one thing. He's just letting us know how glorious he is. That's what he's doing with this vast universe. It's a message that he's sending to the human race, that he is great, that he is awesome. We live, as you know, in the Milky Way galaxy. Earth is located in the Milky Way galaxy, which is estimated to be 100,000 light years in diameter. So when we read Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, this is what Genesis 1 is referring to. This vast, incomprehensible universe with billions upon billions upon billions upon billions of stars and planets and all of these different kinds of things. So in the beginning, God created the heavens, but also here he created the earth. Now, notice as we go into the second verse, as we pointed out before, it reads, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And what's being described here is the immediate state of things as God brings them into existence. because, of course, he's going to create this thing through a process of 6 days. Now, the question arises, well, why did God take 6 days? Augustine argued that God could have created it in 6 seconds if he wanted to. And he's right, he could have. Why did he take 6 days? I think from Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, we realize that God took 6 days in order to set a pattern for man, that he would labor 6 days and he would rest on the seventh day as God did. That seems to be the only reason for the 6 days. But again, there's a process that's underway here now. So at this point, the picture of the earth, and again, to quote Henry Morris, is one of all the basic material elements sustained in a pervasive watery matrix throughout the darkness of space. Elements of matter and molecules of water were present, but not yet energized. The force of gravity was not yet functioning to draw such particles together into a coherent mass with a definite form. Neither were the electromagnetic forces yet in operation, and everything was in darkness. The physical universe had come into existence, but everything was still and dark. No form, no motion, no light. So here we are on that first day. And then what do we read? And God said, let there be light. Let there be light. So God speaks now and he brings light into the situation. And each time as we go through the creative process now, as God is assembling, it's going to use that same terminology. And God said, and God said, and God said. And of course, that reminds us of something that we have read in the New Testament. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things were made through him, and not one single thing was made that was not made by him. So each time we read and God said, we're reading about the role of the Word, who we know as Jesus, in the creation process. So God speaks and he brings light into existence. And once again, I quote Henry Morris, this is where the electromagnetic forces came into operation, producing light waves. These light rays were impinging on the earth as it rotated on its axis during the first 3 days of essentially the same intensities and directions as those which would later emanate from the heavenly bodies to be emplaced on the fourth day. So already God has set the earth on its axis and it's already rotating because we have this evening and morning first day thing. But at this point, the sun is not created. Now, for some time, people had a difficulty with that. How could you have light, and especially with this evening morning thing, without the creation of the sun? And so some speculated that, well, when we come to the fourth day, it's talking about God not creating the sun or forming it literally, but maybe just putting it in its proper position. And although that might sort of take away some of the difficulty a little bit for us, that's not what the text says. So it's better to go with what the text says and to realize this, that there are certain things that we just probably can't understand. And that would stand to reason if we have a God who can create a universe that is 156 billion light years in diameter. He probably will do a few things that we just can't quite get our heads around. And we ought to be okay with that, really. And you know, this is the problem. So often with our little finite brains, we're trying to figure these things out. And we don't have all of the information. We don't even have the capacity. You know, I have said this often and I want to say it again. I think it is the height of folly and arrogance for a human being who is going to live a maximum 100 years to pontificate about millions or billions of years. I mean, think about that for a moment. You know, when you read some of these guys like, you know, if it would have been maybe like Isaac Asimov before, or Carl Sagan, or some of these different guys, Stephen Jay Gould, and, you know, they are always pontificating about the millions and the billions of years, and I think, you know, how utterly foolish and how arrogant that we would think that we would know anything about anything like that, a creature that lives a maximum 100 years. You see, the safest thing to do is to take the Bible at face value, let it speak for itself, and if we can grasp it, if we can confirm it scientifically, if we can, you know, through experimentation come to see it, yeah, you know, it all fits together, great. If we can't, it's okay. It's okay. Because there are just lots of things that we are never going to be able to figure out. And we need to have enough confidence in God and in His Word that when it comes to those kinds of things, I'm content to just leave it in the Lord's hands. And I know Him well enough. I know His love well enough. I know that, you know, I can trust that it'll all get sorted out in the long run. But it's when a person insists on, you know, I've got to have all of the answers or I've got to put it all in a system, that's when we get ourselves into trouble. And so God brings light into existence on the first day. Of course, God is Himself light. We read in the book of Revelation, which is the consummation of all things, Genesis, the beginning of all things, Revelation, the consummation of all things, we read about the New Jerusalem, that there will be no need for the sun and the moon, for the Lord God is the light thereof. So the Lord will be the light of the New Jerusalem, but it says this, it says, and the nations who are saved will walk in the light of that holy city. So the Lord Himself will be the light. There will be no sun and moon shining in the New Jerusalem, and the New Jerusalem will be projecting light onto the nations of the world. All of this to say, if you have some sort of a problem with God creating light apart from the sun, get over it. It's not any kind of a big deal. Remember when Paul was on the road to Damascus? What did he see? He saw a light shining brighter than the noonday sun. Now, can you imagine what the noonday sun is like in the deserts of Damascus? It's brilliant, it's bright, it's intense. Paul sees the light that's outshining the sun. But you see, these are the things that sometimes people have gotten tripped up over, and we don't need to get tripped up over it. It's just as God said. He spoke, He said, let there be light. And so, God divided the light from the darkness. He called the light day, the darkness night, so the evening and the morning were the first day. Then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. Now, on the first day, remember, the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the deep or the face of the waters. And so the earth itself in its unformed state, God is beginning to form it, but it's submerged in water. And so what God does on the second day is He divides the waters. He divides the waters below, which would remain in a liquid form, and then there are waters that are above the firmament. So the word firmament literally means expanse. And of course, heaven, the atmosphere, is what's being described here. So we have a situation where we still have the earth itself inundated in water, but now we have this expanse. We have the heavens. And now in a vapor form, the waters have now been separated and they're now above the heavens at this point, as well as below it. This would have created, according to many, a water vapor canopy over the earth that would have produced a global greenhouse effect. And if you think through what that would have resulted in, it helps us to understand some of the other things that we're told a little bit later in Genesis that are a little bit baffling to us. One of the things that helps us to understand is the longevity of life back during that time before the flood. So if you think of it in terms of this water canopy, again, Morris says, this would maintain an essentially uniformly pleasant warm temperature all over the world. The combination of warm temperature and adequate moisture everywhere would be conducive later to the extensive stands of lush vegetation all over the world with no barren deserts or ice caps. And many of you know that in places like Antarctica and Siberia and places they've found beneath the surface, way down, they've found evidence of a former tropical vegetation in those areas. A vapor canopy would also be highly effective in filtering out ultraviolet radiation, cosmic rays, and other destructive energies from outer space. Thus, the canopy would contribute effectively to human and animal health and longevity. Now, as we go further into Genesis, of course, we're going to come to the story of the flood ultimately. And one of the things that occurs during the flood is that the windows of heaven are opened. And many people believe that that water vapor canopy, it was during the time of the flood that all of that was released from heaven onto the earth. And that is what resulted in the flood, as well as the fountains of the great deep being broken up. So that water vapor canopy no longer exists today. But that is what is being described here as we look at the second day of creation. Then in verse 9, God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. So God separates the waters from under the heavens, and he brings forth the dry land, and he brings forth now the vegetation. You know, I really am not scientifically oriented in my mental processes. I wish I was more so. I wish I could retain all the stuff I've heard over the years or read over the years. But the little bits and pieces that I pick up here and there, again, when you start to see how this whole system is so intricately connected, it's really astounding. You see, obviously, that there is a great intellect behind this. You see that there is a great purpose behind this. But think about vegetation for a moment. We read here about the grass. And this would be a reference to all of the ground coverings, not just your Bermuda grass or, you know, whatever you might have in your front yard. And then we've got the herbs, which would be the shrubs and the bushes. And then, of course, we've got the trees. But think about how vitally important those things are to us, but how I think, especially in our generation, we take so many of these things for granted. I mean, honestly, when you go into the grocery store, into the vegetable section, are you realizing that this is part of what God created on the third day of creation? Are you realizing that these are the plants that are being spoken of here? These, you know, for us, they've become food. And sometimes I don't even know if we really consciously think of it in those terms any longer, because we don't go through the process of planting. We don't go through the process of cultivating. We don't go through the process of harvesting and, you know, all of the things that the farmers do. We don't know anything about it. We just show up at the grocery store and pick up our cilantro or our zucchini or, you know, whatever we want. But are we thinking that God made this stuff? Because that's what we're being told here. That's exactly what we're being told here. And so God made the plants. There are some 350,000 different kinds of plants, and plant life is essential to human life, number one, as food, but in another way also, and even in some ways, a more important way, plants not only supply us with food, but plants supply us with oxygen. We, as you know, we inhale oxygen and we exhale carbon dioxide. Plants take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. Plants replenish our oxygen supply. Now, is there anybody that really for a minute would believe that this happened accidentally? How could, you know, here's the thing. And I would imagine that many of you would agree with me. I was saying this to Cheryl last night after I was reading a bunch of these different kinds of things. I just said, you know, a person who understands all of this stuff and still denies the existence of a creator is a most pitiful person. Truly. Because when you look at the complexity, when you look at how all of these systems are interrelated, when you, you know, again, we go out into the forest, we go on vacation, maybe to a lush area, maybe you go to the Hawaiian Islands or somewhere, you see all of this greenery and all that, and it's beautiful for sight, and we've already talked about the food element, but do we realize that without this stuff, we wouldn't even be breathing? That all of this system is working together. It again testifies to the reality of a great mind behind it. And we know who that great mind is. It's the Lord. Again, I quote Henry Morris. And remember a few weeks ago we talked about the age of the universe and the difficulty that some people have with believing that we could possibly live in a young universe and on a young earth. But this is relevant to that topic. He says, it is significant that these plants were made not as seeds. So it doesn't say that on the third day God planted a bunch of seeds all over the earth. But what does it say? The green grass, the herbs, the trees. So they were not planted as seeds, but as full-grown plants whose seed was in themselves. They thus had an appearance of age. The concept of creation of apparent age does not, of course, suggest a divine deception, as some have indicated, but it is a necessary accompaniment of genuine creation. The processes operating in creation week, here's the key, were not the processes of the present era, but were processes of creating and making and are thus not commensurate with present processes at all. Adam was created a full-grown man, the trees were created full-grown trees, and the whole universe was made as a functioning entity, complete and fully developed right from the beginning. The apparent age that might be calculated in terms of present processes would undoubtedly be vastly different from the true age as revealed by the Creator. See, this is what many people either don't understand or fail to accept, is that the processes that we have presently occurring are not the processes that were occurring when God created everything. That was a unique moment, a six-day period in history, and everything changed after that moment. But God created, as we see here, He created all of these things in a full-grown state. In verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. And let there be signs and seasons and for days and years. Let them be for signs and seasons, days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And so now we come to the fourth day. And God makes. And the word make here is a different, remember the Hebrew word that we looked at a while back, the Hebrew word bara, God created, he created out of nothing. We'll come to that word again in a moment. But here it's a different Hebrew word, asa, which means that God is forming out of existing material. So he forms now the sun and the moon and the stars. And that light that was originally there for the first 3 days, he now diverts that or whatever he does at this point. But now the sun becomes the source. And of course, the moon reflects the light of the sun. And then you have the light of the stars. But notice what it says. It says that these are for signs, seasons, days, and years. For signs, seasons, days, and years. For signs. Some believe the various star formations that we know today as the zodiac. Some believe that those star formations originally told the story of redemption. And among the ancient Hebrews, there was writing about the Maseroth. And the Maseroth was, in the thinking of many, kind of the story of redemption in the stars. That's believed by some. But God definitely says that these things are for signs. When you read through the Old Testament, you find that the new moons were the sign of the time of Israel's appointed feast. And so that would be an application of the sign. You think also of what is called celestial navigation. You know, for centuries, sailors navigated the seas by reading the stars. That's how they understood where they were. That's how they got from place to place. So that could also fall under the category of signs, but then for seasons. You know, it's interesting, and this is something I think to always remember. We have knowledge and information today that 200, 300, maximum 500 years back and before, nobody really knew these things. We know them today. We more or less take all of this stuff for granted. But the things that we know to be true today in regard to seasons, for example, or days or years and the relationship with the sun and so forth, they didn't know that back then. But the authors of the Bible knew it. That's the astounding thing. How did they know this? How did Moses know these things? Well, he could have only known them because God communicated them to him. Nobody else knew these things. But for seasons, winter, spring, summer, autumn, all based on the earth's tilt on its axis and its rotation around the sun. Days. As you know, the day is based on the rotation of the earth on its axis. 24 hours is one full rotation. And a year, of course, is the time it takes the earth to make its revolution around the sun. And so these things are set in their place to give light on the earth and also for signs, seasons, days, and years. And then we come to verse 20, the fifth day. Then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures. Let the birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded according to their kind and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Now, some very significant things took place on the fifth day. First of all, notice this. Then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures. Here is now the introduction of the soul. The plants, you cannot compare plants with animals or people. They're in different categories. Plants do not possess a soul or a consciousness. But the word here, living creature, is the word nephesh, and this is the word that speaks of the soul or the spirit. It speaks of the immaterial part of the creature, the immaterial part that animates the creature. And here's the interesting thing. This is the second time in Genesis where the Hebrew word bara is used. So now God creates again in that sense of bringing something out of nothing. Up until this point, after verse 1, he's been assembling existing material. Now, at this point, once again, when he brings the soul into existence, he speaks it into existence out of nothing. But here's the thing about this that's so important to realize. It shows us that man is not a material being predominantly. It shows us that man and the animals as well, man is of course distinct even from the animals, but that we have a consciousness, we have an immaterial part of us that is not connected to our physical material being. And you know why that's important? Because of psychological theories like determinism and ideas that you are nothing but the result of chemical reactions, the way you think, the way you feel, all of that stuff is the materialist would say the animated part of us is really just another aspect of our physical constitution. What this is telling us is that no, that's not true. God creates a separate thing that's separate from the body. From the material part of man, it's the immaterial aspect. And this is something the animals have. And of course, again, it's something that we have. And so it's the living creature. It's this creature that has a consciousness. And here on the fifth day, it's the fish of the sea and the birds of the air. Now it tells us here in verse 21 that God created great sea creatures. This is an interesting word here as well. The Hebrew word is tannin. And some translations I think actually read sea monsters. Some read whales. The word is most often translated, believe it or not, dragon. And I think what's really being communicated here more than anything is that God created the great sea creatures, the great water dinosaurs. Now there's all kinds of questions and debate and controversy about the dinosaurs, you know, when they lived and so on and so forth. Read Job 40 and 41 and you will realize that dinosaurs lived alongside of men. As a matter of fact, when God speaks of a particular creature that I think is very obviously a dinosaur, God says an interesting thing. He says, now consider Behemoth who I created along with you. Was God anticipating the idea that dinosaurs died out 365 million years before men ever arrived on earth? When he said, consider Behemoth, I created him alongside of you. So great sea creatures, which of course would refer to the whales and the great megalodons and with the water dinosaurs and everything else in the water as well. And then of course here on the fifth day, the birds are created also. And then we come now to the sixth day. And then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to its kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And so God brings forth from the dust of the ground all of the animal life now. The cattle, which would probably be a reference to all domestic animals. The creeping things, which would be everything from the microbes to the millipedes to the mice to the lizards. You know, as many of you know, it's astounding that there is this world of microorganisms. My son-in-law just completed his master's degree in biology. And one day he was telling me about this little creature that lives in the stomach of a mosquito. I didn't even know a mosquito had a stomach. But he's telling me about a creature that lives in the stomach of a mosquito, and he's explained to me what this thing does. This is unbelievable. But there is this microscopic world. And here on the sixth day, when we read about the cattle, the creeping things, the beast of the earth, these things are included as well. But again, these are the things. I think if, you know, probably do all of us a world of good to, you know, take a few classes just to find out, to become more consciously aware of all of the activity that's going on around us, even though we can't see it, to realize again how this whole system is so perfectly woven together. I get the magazine from Answers in Genesis, Answers, and I just received my most recent copy a couple of days ago. And I was reading in there today about bacteria. And it was just amazing stuff that bacteria are the things that everything is dependent on bacteria. I didn't know that. When I think of bacteria, I think, get out the bug spray, or, you know, you got to kill this bacteria. And of course, there are some bacteria that you do have to kill, but most of the bacteria is good bacteria, and it serves this unbelievable purpose. And just a little quote from the article there, it said, bacteria are almost everywhere, busily sustaining life in ways we rarely see or appreciate. God designed bacteria in many cases to make inaccessible atoms available to us. A matrix of bacteria works around the clock to provide many vital ingredients of life. And then, you know, it goes on and it just lists all of these different things that bacteria do, that you realize if the bacteria were not doing these things, we would not be here today. So this whole system, so when we're talking about the creeping things, we're talking about these microbes, we're talking about the obvious creeping things that we can observe with our own eyes, but then we have the beast of the earth. And these are the different categories that God separates things into, and under this category you would have the lions, the tigers, the elephants, the rhinos, but you would also have the land dinosaurs. Again, the Bible is, I think, very straightforward and clear that dinosaurs and man coexisted. Once again, I refer you back to Job 40 and 41. But as we look at all of these things, a few things as we just wrap things up now. Remember, I pointed this out before, but I want to emphasize it again. Remember, here in the first chapter, we read this phrase 10 times, after its kind. After its kind. This is the antithesis of evolutionary thinking, that everything reproduces after its own kind. Now, here's the reality. All of the present evidence supports what Genesis says. There is nowhere in the world, in all recorded history, where anybody has witnessed anything other than things reproducing after their own kind. You remember Darwin thought that he had evidence for evolution because of the differences in the beaks of these finches in the Galapagos Islands. But what Darwin evidently didn't stop to think was that even though there were variations within the beaks, they were still finches. And that's the whole thing. Of course, we believe and we understand from the biblical record itself that God has created kinds, and within these kinds, there's a tremendous amount of variation, but one kind cannot transfer to another kind. One kind cannot reproduce with another kind. So not only has there never been any of this type of thing witnessed by anybody, it's not there as it was believed to be in the fossil record either. And Darwin knew this. He knew that the fossil record would either confirm or refute his idea. And he was convinced, and so were the men of his generation, and so are people still today, that they would eventually find in the fossil record what you call a transitional form, a creature who is in a process of transition from one kind to another. And of course, back in the early days, they anticipated that there would be millions of such creatures. But lo and behold, to this very day, they have never found a single transitional form, not one. Why? Because there's no such thing. Because everything reproduces according to its own kind, just like God said, and you can breed and breed and breed and interbreed and outerbreed and do any form of breeding you want, but it's never going to happen because God established it this way. As we close real quickly, Earth is the most unique place in all of the universe. Copernicus was the one who brought forth the idea, which appears to be the truth, that the Earth is not the center of the universe or the solar system. And, you know, he showed that to be true physically, but the antagonist toward the faith have taken the ideas of Copernicus and basically what they have stated is that the Earth is not only at the center of the universe, the Earth is an irrelevant planet. It's just a little dot in the middle of space, and they've relegated it to irrelevancy. But from the standpoint of what we know for sure, factually, in all that we know presently about the universe, all that we know about our galaxy, all that we know about our solar system, there is not another planet in all of the universe that we know of that has anything like we have on planet Earth. Now, of course, these guys are very optimistic. They're certain that they're going to find those other planets. And I was just reading in the news the other day, they're talking about we think we found Earth's twin planet. You know, they're always looking for life on Mars or something to, all of this is an effort to, you know, refute what the scripture says, to undermine the idea that the Earth is a special place, that man is a special creature made in the image of God and so forth. But if you just look at the facts, Earth is the most unique place in the universe. Real quickly, Earth is just the right distance from the sun. Exactly the right distance from the sun. If it were any closer or further, or if there was 1% more or less energy, the Earth would be too hot to live on, or it would be completely covered in ice. The Earth is tilted at 23 degrees. Without the tilt, the poles would be colder, the equator would be much hotter, and we would have half as much land as we do. Most of the plants and animals on the Earth would die. The Earth is just the right size. A smaller Earth would result in weakened gravity. It could not hold either our air or water. Larger Earth, atmosphere pulled closer to the surface, life could not exist. The Earth's relation to the moon. If the distance between the Earth and the moon were any different, or now they've realized if the size of the moon were any larger or smaller, life could not exist on Earth. And what is said regarding planet Earth, knowing what we know about the other planets, is that from the observational standpoint, they refer to planet Earth as the friendly planet. It looks like the place you'd want to visit. It looks like the place you'd want to go on vacation. You know, imagine that. You're going to go on vacation. You go down to your local space shuttle center. And, you know, they've got all the planets laid out there. You know, there's Venus and Jupiter and Mars and all the places. And, hey, I'm going to go to Earth. You know, look at that place. It's blue. It's white. It's green. It looks inviting. It's called the friendly planet. It is the friendly planet. The Earth is unique because God made it to be the home of man. He made it to be our home. He also made it to become the place where His Son would eventually come, live, labor, suffer, and die in order to display His glory and His love. And if nothing else, maybe this was just a bunch of rambling tonight. But if nothing else, when you look up into the sky and you consider the heavens, remember they are the work of His fingers. But He's thinking about you. He's thinking about me. And His thoughts toward us, get this, 1 billion galaxies? How many stars in those galaxies? We couldn't even count it. But His thoughts toward us are more in number than the stars in the heavens, in the sand, on the sea. And to even make it greater, they're all good thoughts. I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of good, thoughts of peace, not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. That's something to get excited about. That's something to rejoice in.